You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this lovely Monday evening here in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's the 8th of August, 2016 already, and I still don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up. But to be honest, I haven't put a lot of thought into it yet. However, I am currently in broadcasting with this very show, and I am sure that tonight, with a little effort, I'll learn a lot about my job from my guest. Sterling BF is with me this evening, a man who has enjoyed a very successful career in radio broadcasting for over 20 years, and he's a published poet, a singer-songwriter, a guitarist, an all-around incredible guy, generally, and a dear friend of mine. Sterling, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Adam. Generally, I got a caveat there.
Well, I had to give us something to talk about. You know, when you bring a guest on, you know, it's kind of like, we've already talked about everything. But it's always fun for me in preparing for a show. I have an opportunity to do a little review on somebody that I know casually, and then you get to know through, you know, the process. But it's always fun to then learn a little bit more when you read the official bio.
The official bio.
And one of the things I forgot is that you're one of the rare individuals that you can meet in this town that was born in Phoenix.
I am a native, and I married the only other one.
Yeah, we're... Wow. Now, that is very unique.
It is, and I've always regarded it as a very efficient thing to do. You just start here. You don't have to pay to relocate. You just stay here, and in your lifetime, you've lived in five or six different cities because the place changes so much.
Well, that's the truth. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to actually talk to you about being that you were born in Phoenix and have seen this city change so much. I mean, what was the north end of town when you were born?
The north end of town? I was in Central Phoenix, so you got to Bethany Home, you were in farms. I'm old. Yeah. 15th Avenue was a two-lane road.
Well, there weren't many cities in the United States that have grown as fast as Phoenix.
It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, Vegas has seen some pretty dramatic growth in recent years, but I mean, Phoenix has just exploded. I've been here since 89, and it's tripled in size.
Yep.
Yeah, since 89.
Well, yeah, what I remember is a place that was a lot darker. You know, mm-hmm. The street lamps were closer to the ground. They mm-hmm. weren't spraying light from 40 feet up, and you could actually see the stars at night. You know, mm-hmm. And like I say, streets were... I grew up near Encano Park, too, and even the park looked different because now it's very well trimmed. There's nothing down to the ground because people sleep and hide in there, right? So it was kind of a foreboding place, I guess, that I never knew. It was just a place that I hung out, but yeah.
So what parts of town have you lived in?
Pretty much within Central Phoenix. I've lived as far east as 19th Street and Thomas, and as far west as 10th Avenue.
That's pretty interesting. I mean, everyone would certainly think, in knowing you and speaking with you, that you're a fairly, you would describe as a worldly guy, meaning you know, you're aware of so much, involved in a lot of different things, but you've only lived a few miles from where you were born.
Yeah, it lets your brain wander in other ways, I guess.
That's true. Where did you go to school? Did you stay in state?
I did, yeah. Here in town, I started high school at Brophy, and then I got there, at the time, there was no music. There was a little clique of guys who got together and talked about music and did some musical things, but there was no orchestra, there was no band, of course. And that had been my life since I was 3 years old, and there were no girls, so what am I doing here, right? Took a year and a half to finally extricate myself, and I ended up at West High, which is no longer high school, it's Metro Tech now.
Okay.
And that place had they were building, I think at the time it was a $12 million building for music, if you can believe it or not, in this town. And there I was in orchestra, band, chorus. I was in chamber ensembles, took theory and harmony. It was a great program. Here.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Back then,
yeah.
Some of the schools, I think it equates to some of the high schools now that have been building production programs and recording studios. I remember assisting South Mountain High School when they were putting their recording studio in. I walked in their control room and I thought, this is nicer than anything in town commercially. This is in a high school. You know, what are you guys doing over here? And a lot of the schools have really decent facilities for multimedia production, and they have for years now.
Well, KJZZ, our sister station at KBOC, is involved with Spot 127, which is exactly that. It's multimedia. It's for kids to come after school. It's an after-school program with lunch, and yeah, it's really cool.
You know, speaking of kids and multimedia, these days every 10-year-old with a cell phone is editing video all day long.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine how this is going to impact a generation from now, filmmakers, when you've been making films on your phone since you were 10.
I can't, yeah.
It's
staggering. Makes my head hurt.
Yeah, it's really staggering to think what's their perspective is going to be on when they're making serious films, assuming that still exists as fast as things are changing.
Yeah.
Now let's go back to when you were little and talk about music a little bit. You mentioned you were involved in a lot when you were in school, but before school, you were about 3 years old when you started playing started getting trained.
Right, violin at 3, yeah.
How did that come about?
It was
musical family or?
Very musical family, yeah. My mother is still the most creative musician I've ever known. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great pianist, amazing. So yeah, the whole family was musical. My brother played the horn, I played the violin, later the piano took the horn and all sorts of stuff, so yeah.
Was your dad in music as well or no?
My dad loved music. He played the drums, he could play the vibes a little bit. He was great with the spoons. Ever seen anybody really good play the spoons?
No.
It's cool. It really is cool.
I've seen somebody bad play the spoons.
Okay, well, that's a different thing. And there were a couple of things he could play on the piano. He had a great touch. And when he got older, retired, he actually started playing a lot more. But it was certainly encouraged. You know, what do you need? You need a violin? Here, take this one. Right?
Why violin? Were you listening to something at the time? Or you're three, though. I mean,
The story went, at three, I don't know, that my mother wanted me to play the harp. And my father said, no kid of mine is going to play the harp. Which I was always grateful for because I had friends.
Football-playing son of mine.
I had friends who played the cello or lugging that thing around. I can't imagine how you moved a harp everywhere. But violin fit right there neatly on the handlebar on your bike. You get home from your lesson.
Right. And as far as Dad was concerned, you could hide it pretty easily?
No, he was good. So long as I learned to play horse staccato, he was good. And there were certain things. If you can play that, I'm good with it.
Interesting.
So they loved to hear me play. And I didn't, but they did, yeah.
Okay, so then that was pretty young. So, but obviously, that was even before school. So the first time you were in a school program was probably mid-grade school?
Pretty early on in grade school. Again, the town was different then. I was at Franklin School. There was classroom music starting in first grade. And then I think the band was something you get into in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I took the horn and band and played horn through into high school.
The horn? What?
French horn.
French horn?
Yeah.
Cool. You still play French horn?
No.
There aren't a lot of French horn players around.
There are some very good French horn players in this town.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know trumpet players and trombone players more, but not a lot of French horn players.
they're an odd. You gotta have an admiration for anybody who can take, you know, 20 feet of coiled tubing, set it in a lap, and do what they can do with it. It's like, right, you're my hero. You know?
It's pretty amazing. Now, how many brothers and sisters did you have?
One.
Oh, just one brother?
Just one brother.
Older?
Older, 10 years older.
Okay, and you mentioned he played as well?
Mm-hmm, played the horn.
French horn, I guess?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Radio. How did radio creep into your life as a career? What was your first interest in radio?
I really had no interest in radio except for being on radio. I wanted to have my music on the radio. But there was a guy named J.D. Freeman who is now with Clear Channel. He's a vice president with Clear Channel. But at the time, he was the program director here of a station called KBBC, which was playing album cuts.
So this would have been in the 70s, maybe?
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s, yeah. Yeah, I am old. But anyway.
No, you said album cuts. That was my clue. Oh, FM radio came out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
I remember
what do we
that.
Do with this FM frequency? Stereo. Woo.
It was so cool. And they'd have a hit song, but on FM, they'd play all the other cuts from the record in the beginning. That's kind of what it was doing. That was a lot of fun.
And all of a sudden, you knew about bands you'd never heard of before. So with them, I was doing a lot of runouts and things. They had events they would do around town, so they'd have me come and play. And it was J.D. and a guy named Craig Henderson, who at the time was a production director for those stations, which were then KBBC and KTAR. He later became the morning guy at KTAR, really great radio guy. They were trying to tell me, try radio. And what really got me into radio was my second child was born, and being my second and third, surprise twins, right? This would never happen anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that you can, in fact, laugh and cry by turns, you know? thrilled, happy, and realized, oh my God, I can't pay for any of this. What am I going to do? So I read a book called What Color Is Your Parachute? And you go through, and it goes through music, recording studios, and all the stuff you've done. And I don't remember the process, but you end up with a piece of paper, and at the very end is a phrase, and it said classical broadcasting. So the next day I called Tori Malatia at what was then KHEP. Tori brought me in and had me go in a studio, and I don't know why he hired me, but thank God he did. And the next thing you know, I'm on the radio.
So how old were you when you first ended up on the radio then like that?
Oh, it is. It's 30 years ago. I was 20, well, almost 30.
So at that point, you've kind of gotten out of your pursuing the rock star career. I mean, let's back up again. Because just getting back to music, getting into your life. I mean, 3 years old, playing violin and going through school. But What was some music that motivated you, got you interested in playing out and performing? I mean, pop music you might have heard on the radio or music you heard around the house?
Well, because it was a musical household and everybody had his say in what we heard, it was everything from the Mills Brothers, that my dad loved the Mills Brothers and the big band and big band groups. And my mom was into classical. My brother was into more avant-garde classical stuff. And I'm a little older than you, and all of a sudden there's this group called the Beatles singing, "I Want to Hold Your Hand." And I remember I was on a camping trip with my friend, and we were in the car, and this song comes on, and my world changed.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
It's like you've heard a lot of music, and then a piece of music comes on that just strikes a chord with you that's so different.
I hadn't even seen him yet.
And that did that with everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something really strange about that record. Wonder what it was.
But it was a great time for music. There's a lot happening now, but back then, it was the big shift. I mean, Capitol Records went from being where Nat King Cole's label. He basically built the building, and 7 years later, he walks in. Nobody knows who he is because the Beatles have taken over. But there was still the Rosemary Clooney effect. It was all that great stuff going on. And Patsy Cline, who's gone by then, I guess, right?
Yeah, I don't remember
all
exactly
those great sounds, though, that were happening. It was just all over the place. And then there was the Phil Oakes and the folks, Ian and Sylvia and all that stuff. So.
I think Frank Sinatra was on Capitol, too, wasn't he? Had Frank, and you had the Beach Boys run the Capitol from the American side.
Yeah,
you
know? Well, then the Warner Group came up. You know, you had the Warner Reprise, and
I mean, we could just talk about the record industry with our experiences.
Which would be really interesting. Let's do that.
But I want to go back. I know growing up in my house back in the Midwest, my dad wasn't a musician, but he was into music, and he had a bunch of old records that we'd listen to. And he had a couple trumpet players. Al Hurt was one that I used to listen to all the time, which is why I started playing trumpet. But the Mills Brothers was a group that he enjoyed as well. And so I did a little YouTube looking for the Mills Brothers this morning, thinking, you know, gosh, I don't really remember the Mills Brothers that well. Let me just take a little listen here. And I found three different versions of Paper Doll that I thought were really pretty cool. And one of them actually was on the Dean Martin Show.
Okay.
You remember Dean Martin's
show?
Where he came out, he brought the guys out, and they discussed how they used to make horn sounds with their hands and part of their shtick, you know, one doing the trumpet, one doing the trombone. Well, then, of course, you know, Dean sang Paper Dolls with him, but, of course, he told him he was going to sing with him, and as soon as he opened his mouth, they sang instead, and, you know, he was put out. But he got to sing a few lines, and it was pretty comical. He had a nice band on the show, but I found another live version of the recording of Paper Dolls that the guys did on a TV show. With a big band behind him, too. Because the record is just acoustic guitar and vocals, real sparse, kind of dark, and albeit by our attention span today, fairly boring. You have to wait so long to get to the first harmonies, which is what they're famous for. You know. But with the big band live bit on TV and a little bit of banter, I thought it was a little more interesting. So I wanted to play just a little piece of Paper Dolls by the Mills Brothers for you this afternoon. So here you go.
But here's an old song. Lawrence, I think you said it was your favorite, Paper Doll.
I'm gonna buy a paper doll. But all that else can I steal?
I do not blame you.
And then the flirty, flirty guys with their flirty, flirty eyes will have to flirt with dollies that are real. When I come home at night, she will be waiting.
Oh, will she?
She'll be the truest doll in all this world. I'd rather have a paper doll to call my own than have a fickle, flattered real life girl.
I guess I had a million dolls or more. I played it all the more and more. I just quarreled with Sue, and that's why I'm blue. She's gone away and left me just like all dolls do. I'm telling you boys, it's tough to be alone, and it's tough to love a doll that's not your own. I'm through with all of them.
Paper Doll by the Mills Brothers. You remember that one?
I do. You know, what's cool about stuff like that is you listen to it, and it's not note perfect, right? There's this big push now for everything being note perfect. The music breathes. They're not always, even in their studio recordings, there's just a little bit of life and energy it gets because they're feeding off each other. It's just kind of cool.
Yeah, it's the tools we have today. But one of the things that really surprises me when I go back and look at some of this old stuff is how energetic the performers were and they were still on pitch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at somebody like the Jackson 5 or the Osmond Brothers, and these guys were dancing around like crazy, yeah, singing harmony and staying on pitch.
Yeah.
And today you've got pop stars dancing around like crazy, but their mics are off because there's no prayer they're going to be anywhere near.
And everybody
pitch
assumes that was the case with the Jacksons and the Osmonds. You know,
yeah,
it wasn't. They were doing it. Yeah.
They did it live, which is just phenomenal, the amount of effort that went into them.
There was another band at the same time as this called the Ink Spots. Have you ever heard
of
them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, in fact.
Yeah.
There's a cool Ink Spots project in town going on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Renee Patrick.
My dad loved them. I could never get into it because almost every song they did had a spoken break.
Mm-hmm.
And it just bothered my sensibility. Even when I was little, it's like, this is a little embarrassing.
Why are they talking?
Yeah, it's like, wait, sing the dang thing, right? Yeah.
Interesting.
But again, there was a thing where everything breathed. It was this really cool sound. Mm-hmm. It was definitely, as soon as it starts, you know it's the Mills Brothers. You know, mm-hmm, it's the Ink Spots.
Mm-hmm.
You know it's the Dorsey Band.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that some of that's coming back too. I think things have been so fixed and processed in pop music so much. And a lot of artists recognize that they feel like the life has been kind of sucked out of the production by the time it's done, that there's been a little bit of a backlash. And since the record companies aren't necessarily, don't quite have the stranglehold on the market that they did, you know, today, there's a lot more avenues, a lot more independent success stories, a lot more people that make their own record before the record companies get involved. They, mm-hmm, actually license the product on its way up, and now it's too late to fix it.
Right.
You know, it's already working. Let's,
yeah,
just put money behind
it. Leave
it
alone.
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting stories I heard a few years ago is Tom Petty was so you know, disgusted with the concept of loud records. Everything had to be so loud that they decided to skip mastering. Now, for those in the recording world, they understand that we record a song and then we mix it, which is like blending, you know. When you get the mix done, you would send it to mastering where they kind of put a cap on, lid on the whole thing and kind
it's
of...
It's magic what they do.
Yeah. Well, one of the magic tricks they perform is to make it really loud and then squash it with an audio compressor. And we've gotten to the point where we do so much compression during the mix process that then to compress during the mastering process really squeezed any remaining life out of the tracks.
And you don't even know what radio stations are doing.
20-to-1 slammed, limiting.
Oh,
you know,
yeah. Even just dubbing it over to... Well, it used to be you had to dub it over to something you could play.
Right.
And you're processing it again, so you've got compression every step of the way.
I know, and in fact, a funny compressor story for you audio geeks. I was working on a rap record with DMX, local guy, gets in trouble once in a while, and I had an audio compressor on his microphone, and of course, you have to. I mean, when you have a vocal performance like that where it's just screaming to nothing to screaming, you know, you have to have an audio compressor. And so after like halfway through, he's cussing at me, you know, do you have a compressor on my voice? Take that off. Sounds like I can't breathe. And I'm like, no, I don't. I lightened it up a little bit. It's like, hell yes, I do. Are you out of your mind? There's no way I can record this without a compressor. But it does bring all the quiet things up, like breathing, mm-hmm, and all the loud things down, you know. And I remember hearing Ringo Starr on an interview on the radio, and the voiceover had been so compressed and the broadcast was so compressed that his breaths in between lines were so loud, I could hardly listen to him talk.
Yeah.
It's like, blah, 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 blah. It was just disgusting, and people don't get that that's an audio compressor. So at any rate, Tom Petty had decided on that record a couple records ago to skip mastering. They said, we've got enough compression. We like the record the way it sounds. We're just going to go straight to manufacturing.
Mm.
And that's, I don't know a lot of people that have made that choice, but it was interesting that a star wanted to back away from that. And I heard a record recently that I actually brought a cut to play for you for a different reason.
Okay.
By Sarah Giroux. Do you know Sarah?
I don't.
And her new record, I thought, could use a little compression. Because she gets loud and then she gets so quiet that you're on your car stereo, turning it up for the quiet parts and turning it down when it's loud. And ultimately, that's the goal of compression, to kind of keep that from happening. But I wanted to get your take on her song, which we'll play in a little bit, because it comes back to you as a singer-songwriter, which we haven't even talked about yet, and I want to get into. But your radio career has been primarily classical music-oriented, mm-hmm, but your music interest and taste is extremely broad, including pop all across the board and jazz. And so as a songwriter, you write some really interesting pieces, which we'll play as well. And who I would say... or I'd like to ask you, who would you consider some of your biggest influences as a writer?
Songwriter.
Yeah.
Well, Gordon Lightfoot, Paul Simon, Randy Newman.
Right, who's
just
amazing.
Yeah. Danny O'Keefe.
Who's I saw Randy when he played in town in Scottsdale.
Yeah. I used to go every time he came. It was just hysterical. Man. Talk about a guy who's, you know, not note perfect, right?
Right.
Man, with some creative stuff. But Danny O'Keefe, who I think is a national treasure, who kind of walked away from his career after an album called American Roulette that he made with, you know, he was working with the Eagles and Jackson Brown, all these guys, and he just kind of walked away, moved back to Seattle, and he's just trying to do it on his own. But great stuff.
Did you follow his career via interviews? I mean, do you know why he walked away? What was his deal?
I don't know what happened. I just remember that those last few albums are just so different. You know, and they weren't box office hits. They weren't selling bazillions of copies. They were just great tunes, well produced.
Right, and so just for those of you that may not remember who Danny O'Keefe is, here's a piece of one of his songs. Live recording as well. Big hit song.
Everybody's gone away.
Now I think everybody has recognized it.
Believe this time they're gonna stay. Not a soul I know around. Everybody's leaving town. Some caught a freight, some caught a plane. Find our sunshine.
This recording is only a handful of years ago.
Yeah.
It sounds great.
It does.
He still sounds incredible.
It was a song of his called The Road. You remember that one? He did it. Jackson Brown covered it on the radio. I think Leo Sayer, of all people, did that song. Good stuff.
Willie Nelson has a great copy of this, too.
Good Time Charlie?
Yeah.
Good Time Charlie's got the blues. Good Time Charlie's got.
Okay, so some of these guys were influences in your songwriting, and I can hear that. I always thought your stuff was a little folky influenced as well from that period, you know, the 60s singer-songwriter stuff.
That was it, singer-songwriter.
Have you seen the Laurel Canyon, Live from Laurel Canyon show that comes in and out of the MIM on occasion?
No.
You would love it.
Yeah.
You got to go. A buddy of mine is the main guy who's the performer in it, Brian Chartrand. And you'd enjoy Brian's stuff as well if you caught him out and about town, which he plays a lot. But it's a show dedicated to all the singers and songwriters through a short period of time, and they talk about how their relationships interwove and interacted, and who wrote what at what house, and they play it, you know, in a big 9-piece band. You'd really dig it. It's a lot of fun.
I'll have to check it out. That was a neat movement. Just when all of a sudden, that idea of writing songs 10, 20 years before, that was narcissism.
Right.
But everything was first person. My experience. Can you relate to this? It was a whole different. I think that got kind of missed. And the dialogue about who were these guys, you know? Because we think back on Paul Simon, it's Bridge Over Troubled Water in those days. But they were very personal songs.
Well, and I think that before some people credit it to the Beatles. I don't know that it's that they were necessarily the first ones got away with writing their own songs. But before that, it really was the singer-songwriter teams at the labels being told, hey, today we're doing a Leslie Gore record, or we're doing an Elvis record this week. We need songs. And guys would crank out songs. No artists wrote their own stuff, which is still very much the case in Nashville, which is still more of a songwriting machine designed to provide product for the singers. And when you listen to it, you get it. You're like, oh, wow, that could be sung by any current country pop star, and it would still be a hit. But you take, you know, a rock or a pop song outside of that genre, and like Red Hot Chili Peppers is a great example. I think half their songs wouldn't be hits by other bands. It's the sound that they have that really makes them special. You know, it's their own style. And that style isn't something that's relied on in country music. It's more the song.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But as you were writing now, let's say you were playing out, doing local shows, playing around in bars, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was a different town then, too, for that. I can remember playing at Macayo's used to have each Macayo's had a bar where there was a dance floor. The dance floor wasn't really used then because they were really bringing in singer-songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
It was Lund Avenue Marble Club, which is a great venue. There were two or three of those in town.
Right.
Backstage in Scottsdale, there was one in Tempe that was my favorite room in town, backstage off Broadway, which was really like being in a hall. You had the first floor, and then there was a second floor. So you're just looking out. You can't see anybody. It's just bright lights. It was a blast to play there. Yeah, but they were mainly bar. Your job is to make people drink, you know,
right,
and have them stick around.
So you do your best. And today your job is to make sure they drink and then make sure they don't go home. Or at least don't drive home.
Exactly. Please don't drive home. Yeah.
So most kids who are teenagers out playing in clubs have the dream of becoming a star, getting their record, their music heard on the radio. Where did that take you? Did you have that kind of dream, that kind of aspiration?
Sure. You have the aspiration. You don't know if it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'd played in a few bands. Usually it's with friends who were, you know, great guys, they good instincts, but nobody reads music. Nobody, mm-hmm. you know, you can't really write a chart down, so you're just kind of winging it every time you're playing.
Right.
It was a group. I had a bass player named Joe Hammer that I worked with most of the time I was playing. Joe was just a great bass player, and he was in a band called Authority, and I joined that group for a while. And we were big on the statewide high school circuit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the touring we did. And then I just started playing solo, and then I didn't like that. So I would take a gig somewhere and have a couple of friends, Joe Hammer and a guy named Dar Bradley, we were just known as my first name because I was writing most of it. At that time, it was kind of cool because I was writing everything. We covered a few things, but most of the stuff we did was original, and
cool.
People came to hear it.
So the band was called Sterling?
Sterling. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. That was my little bit of narcissism, I guess, right?
That's a great name.
It gave me a great experience, though. It was a place called Woolworths. Remember Woolworths stores?
You don't remember? Yeah, I remember the stores, yeah.
I went down to the second story of the basement of Woolworths is always a great place. That's where the cutout bins were for the album, so mm-hmm. you could go through and find a record for 75 cents or a dollar. And I'm down there with the records and where the stationery and all that stuff is. And around the way, I hear somebody singing, and I realize it's my song. And I had read a book Leonard Bernstein wrote saying, "Just once, I'd like to hear somebody singing my song," which I couldn't believe. He'd never had that happen. You know, when he wrote the book, I guess he hadn't. But here I am, a Woolworths, and I just hung around the other aisle and just listened to her until she wandered away. I thought, that is really cool.
So it was another artist, but she was singing your song?
It wasn't an artist. It was just somebody who'd been to the club, I guess. Maybe she heard it on KBBC. I don't know how she heard the thing.
Interesting. So then did you ever move to Hollywood and, you know, take the big shot?
Didn't move. I had a great guy who was named Tom Shannon who represented me. And he took me to Hollywood and introduced me around. And came very close to signing a deal with a record label until they explained to me what was entailed. And
what do you mean by that? What record company?
Well, his deal was, he was talking about RCA.
Yep.
And I knew RCA. I think RCA was Nilsson, right? And I was freaking out. I think that was his album. Was
maybe,
his
yeah. I'm not sure.
So they were some pretty cool cats.
Yeah.
It wasn't anybody I was really... that was about as far in RCA's catalog as I got was Harry Nilsson. Somebody came along to explain how it would all work. You know, you'll be on the road this long, this many months.
And you're what? How old are you?
20.
Okay.
You know, 20, 21. Okay. You'll be on the road this many months. You'll be in the studio this long. You'll have this much money to make that first record. If you don't sell this many copies, you won't get the second. It's a deal worth this much, but they're not going to spend it all. Oh, my head was swimming.
Right.
And then... It was Laurel Canyon. The guy's house was in Laurel Canyon. We spent
right.
2 days sitting at a piano just going over songs. And you know the stuff that you mm-hmm. know of mine. You wouldn't mm-hmm. recognize any of this as being me. This is all pop ditties. And I think, mm-hmm. wait a minute, I'm going to get locked into playing this stuff. Oh, my God, I can't play this the rest of my life.
Yeah, if it's successful, you are. That's the, you know, you better like that hit song.
That's right. So I ran for the hills. I was terrified I didn't realize until I was much older that it was fear of success. If
mm-hmm.
this takes off and it's something I can't control, then my life's not my own. I really wanted to have a family and I wanted to write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't make any money doing it, but I'm still writing songs.
Yeah,
you know?
That's fascinating. So you were right there at the place every kid thinks he wants to be, and you realized, I'm not sure I really want this.
Well, yeah, the story is even more sordid. Two occasions, on two of the trips that I was in Laurel Canyon with this guy,
mm-hmm.
and he was a great guy. I loved the guy.
Right.
And he had a great track record, some really interesting. His name was Richard Delvey, and he's gone now, but he was just a great guy, and especially nice to me. We went out to dinner, and you're in this, in one case it was the Brown Derby, the other I can't remember what it was. We had to actually fly like in a tram to the restaurant. I don't know where this place was. But in each case, you're sitting at a table, and there's that smell of patchouli oil that you know is not patchouli oil, right? This is the 70s. And there's substances making their appearance that you realize, wait a minute, I know what that is. And And I told you earlier, I'm a guy who, you know, back then I was smoking cigarettes. Well, I have a pack, I've got three, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, I have one beer, I bought a 12-pack, right? To this day, I don't have a cup of coffee. I drink pots of coffee. I'm a morning guy, for crying out loud.
Right, right.
I thought, well, if I'm around all this stuff, I'm toast. I'm never going to. So I just ran for the hills. Mm-hmm. Called him later and said, look, I'm really sorry. That was a great experience. And here's the thing. And I told him, I said, there's some great studios in town. Told him their names, who was running them. I said, there's some great musicians around this place. I could get some tracks to you. I don't care how you produce it. I'll just send you tracks. He said, nah, it's not the way it works. And it wasn't that many years later. That's exactly how it worked. They weren't doing anything in Goodnight LA. It was all happening in Seattle or somewhere else.
Yeah, it all changes. So you came back from that experience. You must have done something to your head, thinking, well, gosh, I have been putting energy into this, thinking this is where I wanted to go, and if that's not the door I go through, how do I move my music forward?
And the worst part of that scenario is when I really am terrible with is self-promotion. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible with it.
Mm-hmm. Hence your massive footprint in social media.
Found out. That's me. The reluctant Facebook guy. No, even then I was terrible at it. And I thought, well, it was that naivete that, you know, somebody will just realize that's a great song, and then it'll be okay.
They'll take it from there.
And it was reinforced in some, about 1986, I think, I met Mason Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant guy. And he had just made a record called Of Time and Rivers Flowing. And it was an LP. It later came out on CD when those became popular. And I got to interview him, and I said, how are you doing this now? And he told me. And then afterward, I said, you know, I'm a songwriter. He says, you can do anything now. You can just, pressing an LP is not a big deal anymore. It's not a big, you can do this. Well, he could, I couldn't, right? I couldn't get to first base with how to do that.
That's crazy. Now, you and I met, you were on the radio in Phoenix.
Oh, we met because of the Phoenix Symphony was being
produced.
That's
what I was going back through your bio, and I was trying to think, when's the first time I met Sterling? And then I thought, I think you came in because the studio I worked at supplied the mobile facilities to go record the symphony every week. I wasn't involved in those recordings. But then you would go to the show, make some notes, and then you wrote and recorded a voiceover for the radio broadcast the following day or the following weekend or something.
I don't remember what the timing was, but yeah.
So I believe that was our first meeting or session was when you came in to do voiceover over the Phoenix Symphony recordings.
Yeah, and they were crack-ups. See, people wouldn't believe that we're doing the symphony, but we're laughing and making fun of them. You actually did some outtakes that were pretty hysterical.
Oh, good. That's good.
Yeah, those were good times.
I could see me being more interested in the outtakes during my first recordings of classical music. I didn't have an appreciation for it when we met, I don't believe. I had spent no time with it. In fact, I remember going to college. I went to college for just a split second. And I picked music as a minor because you couldn't pick it necessarily as a major. I was at Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. Don't go there looking at my manuscript or my grade point average. And I picked, I had to listen to what was called music appreciation. I thought, well, that'd be easy. I could appreciate music. But it was classical music, and you had to go to the basement of the music building and look up certain pieces of music from certain periods, which I didn't even understand what that meant.
Yep.
And you had to listen to them, and you had to evaluate them on certain levels also, which I didn't understand because I'd never played anything but trumpet in grade school and then grabbed a guitar and played in rock band. So I had no clue what they were talking about. And it was obviously to me going to be much more difficult than I had anticipated. So I skipped my music class like most of my other college classes. But back to how we met. I found out during that time that you were a singer-songwriter. And so you had some material that you wanted to do, and we actually recorded some of your tunes together.
Well, I should say thank you to Lori Geer. That'll happen because Lori,
who worked at the studio,
mm-hmm. and saw that it happened. That's how we ended up in the room together, and I came in with charts and scores and guitars and stuff, and yeah, that was a gas.
And at one point, you had a conversation with Russ Titelman about your music and/or your music career. You were a fan of his, and you connected with him. Unless I'm remembering the story wrong.
I was a big fan, Russ Titelman, yeah. But I don't remember coming in contact with him.
Maybe there was another guy then, and I'm mixing up the stories. Anyway, let's play one of your songs.
Which one?
Well, I was thinking I wanted to play Passion Burns Inside.
Oh, one of the ones we did together.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to hear that. So this was cut in probably, I don't know, 19...
Do you have to say it?
Back in the 1900s, let's go that far. Back in the 1900s, here is Passion Burns Inside from Sterling Biath on the Otto D Show.
One leaf falls, no one is the wiser. When a branch is gone, we recognize the change. If the passion wanes, how will we remember? If there's smoke, will we find the flame? It burns in me, and it burns in you. The passion burns in everything we do. When I catch your eye, we can see the passion burn inside. This is now, it is not forever. When you think of it, that's all we ever have. If we take care of where we are, not where we're going, for where we've been, we'll have fewer scars. It burns in me, and it burns in you. The passion burns in everything we do. When I catch your eye, and you catch mine, we can feel the passion burn inside. One harsh word can carelessly be spoken out of turn. The danger is the silence from which nothing can be learned. When an anxious game of hesitation ends, we can both lose our best friends and risk not finding them again. If the passion wanes, how will we remember? If there's smoke, will we find a flame? It burns in me, and it burns in you. The passion burns in everything we do. When I catch your eye, and you catch mine, we can see the passion. We can feel the passion. We can see the passion burn inside.
You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
That was Passion Burns Inside by Sterling Biath from back in the day.
Yeah, we should put a disclaimer on there. That's not the final mix you gave me. That's a little thin there. So that's not on Otto. That's on some step in the intervening years.
They're all listening on their little computer laptops, so it's no problem. I think it's interesting, though, because I hear a folk influence, but I hear a melodic pop influence and then classical instruments in terms of arrangement style, you know. Because you have a whole lot of things influencing you stylistically, you know.
Well, you're one of those guys who, Tim Honeycutt was the first engineer I ever worked with, and yeah, tried to help me produce some tracks a long time ago. And that's the first thing everybody has to talk me back from, is I keep writing more and more counterpoint, mm-hmm. More and more stuff, and it's just leave it lean, you know. And I'm one of those guys who gets it. You know, music is made up of notes and silence. let the silence be there.
But with classical music influence too, it's all a counterpart. I mean, all the writing and composition, all the different parts, there's a lot involved, a lot in your brain besides a melody, where when you leave all that open, then the arrangement starts to take on some of that naturally with the players, especially when, as you know, working with the top session guys, how easy it is for them to flesh out an arrangement and find their space.
Which is always exciting. When you get good players and you say, here's what I've got, and then all of a sudden they're playing something back to you. It's really cool.
Now, we've been skirting around your radio career, which is really probably the biggest part of your life, you know. You've been on radio in this town for 20-some-odd years, 30 years. And
K-Bog for 20 now.
Yeah, that's what it was. And I was fascinated by some of the names of people that you've interviewed, because I didn't really think about the fact that between your television show you were doing, but also with your radio career, you've had an opportunity to interview a lot of people. And you interviewed, let me just pull up the notes here. I was interested in some of these, blink, 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 blink. It must be on the other page.
If I remember the names, like Yo-Yo Ma's on there. Mrs. Rob Rostropovich. Joanne Folletta.
Annie Leibovitz.
Annie Leibovitz. That was
Janet
a good
Napolitano.
Well, she's a big opera fan. So that
I wonder about how
that
came about. Yeah. So tell me, for example, Annie Leibovitz.
That was cool because she was here at the Art Museum. The Phoenix Art Museum had an exhibition of her work up.
And this was a KBOK broadcast?
And at the time, it was the second iteration of KONC, 106.3. And she'd been doing... I overheard her in an interview with a guy who was very cerebral and wanted to talk about f-stops, and you know, and I am a photographer. I'm not any Leibovitz, but I get f-stops. Right. But this guy was being just so. She looked so annoyed. I thought, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. She's gonna, and we hit it off, and we ended up. It was about an hour long interview, and we just walked through the gallery, and we'd stand and look at stuff, and that was a magical day. Yeah.
Wow, that'd be neat.
Yo-Yo Ma was fun because the first time I interviewed Yo-Yo Ma, we're about the same age. And we're sitting in his room backstage at Symphony Hall. And in the chorus room down the hall, I can hear a cello being played. And he says, and it turns out that's a 13-year-old kid down the hall that he's just met today who's got his Strat.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, so she's down. And he looked at me and said, she's not going to hurt it. I like this guy.
It's a wooden instrument. She's going to be fine.
Yeah.
She's not like the Who.
This is not Pete Townsend down there, right?
Yeah, you can trust it. I wouldn't give it to Pete and leave him alone. So KONC, you were also on KAMJ.
That was when KONC went off the, it was, I was working at the time with a news guy named Dave Tunnell, and I'd known Dave's voice in this town for years and years, and all of a sudden I'm getting to work with this guy. And I remember one morning, I forget how long we'd been doing mornings together, a few months.
Mm-hmm.
And I look outside the studio window, looking out to the lobby, and Dave's standing holding up the paper. And Bud Wilkinson, who at the time wrote a column about radio and television, and the headline, it was big letters, I could read them from that distance, was KONC changes format. I'm live, right? I'm on mic and I'm reading this. Oh my God, what do I... And it was a little while later that in fact we'd been bought out, and it was... Classical wasn't going to cut it.
Well, that's a way to show you.
Yeah, exactly right. That's the way to do it. But luckily, because of my studio background and all, I stayed on. They made me a production director and actually built a studio. We started doing commercial work in-house and for our clients. So I was there for a good long while. Ultimately, there were three stations I was the production director for.
Mm-hmm.
One was the pop station. There was a news station or a big band station and a sports station. So that was there were some 17-hour days in there.
I was going to say. You did all that while your wife was raising the kids, right? You needed something to do.
That's right.
We have three kids.
I'll be home sometime tomorrow.
Kids. I'm just going to take on a second job, become program director. So, but now you are a producer, currently credited as a producer at KBOK today, correct?
Producer and host, yeah. I do the morning show. And
what time are you on?
5 to 10.
Every day?
6 days a week.
6 days a week.
Almost like a Beatles song.
Yeah, really. 6 days a week. So now you don't act from a programmer's point of view like most classical radio hosts. You tend to play a little bit broader.
And I'm no longer that guy. I was the music director for a long time, and they really wanted me to focus on the air. You know,
so they weren't really happy with you putting in all the other pieces.
Yeah,
of
what's
music?
With this Martineau guy? You know, why are we playing this? Enough with that. You know, we got this Chopin. Let's play that. Which is great. I'm not faulting at all what we're doing. There's if you ever have to be an apologist for playing Beethoven and Chopin, then you know
you got a problem.
Yeah, move on.
Right? Yeah, I mean some of that music is so incredible, and it's just amazing how much pop music steals from classical music, and you don't realize that until you're sick and tired of all the pop music, and you start to listen to other stuff.
It would be a gaseous sometime for us to sit down and I'll show you some stuff like you know John Lennon was listening to this by Georges Bizet when he wrote that song because it's the same melody. You know?
Yeah, a lot of stuff is just ripped straight away.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to get your take on this tune I talked about earlier, too, by Sarah Jarosz. This is off of her newest record called Undercurrent, and the song is called Everything to Hide. And if you're not familiar with her, I think you'd enjoy her stuff.
Okay.
But check out just a little bit of this.
Truth is, you're all that I can see in the middle of this crowd. I wanna tell you that I'm thankful for your fingers on those strings. Wanna whisper low into your ear all these forbidden things. But I'll stand right here and hold my tongue. For all I know, I'm the only one. But do you feel this undercurrent and the changing of the tides? When I'm with you, baby, we got everything to hide. When I'm running out of time is when I wanna do it all. When you're running through my mind is when I wanna hear you call. Well, you're always running through my mind, so why don't you call now? It ain't right, but it feels good. Let's do this anyhow. But I'll stand right here and hold my tongue.
So what do you think?
It's really cool, and it's great lyric stuff. What's nice is when there are those songs, well, like the one of mine you played. I don't know why I wrote that song, because there's nothing new in those chords. But that day, those progressions with those words, it just worked. Mm-hmm. And you find that lick she's doing, and she comes around again, and she plays it well, and you match it lyrically so that it all just becomes a unit. Yeah, I like this.
Yeah, you have to check her out. I think you'd like both of her records. But anyway, that's enough of that. There was something else I wanted to talk to you about with your radio work. Let me go back through those notes. Any exciting stories?
You have notes.
Well, I do.
Guado.
Like, you know, all these different things you've been and done. You've done a lot of voiceover work for commercials as well.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Back when I actually
coffee,
used sounders
Crystal
like
water.
You have. That's a long time ago. We don't have that in public radio.
Don't have what?
Auto D.
Oh,
bumpers and sound.
Well, I make those. I call my clients. Hey, man, you want to do something for me? I'll knock 2 minutes off your bill if you read this script when you come in next time. In fact, my little tag right there, this one right here that I didn't play that time, let me play this for you and explain it.
You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
That is Irving Jack, also known as James Hop, local singer, songwriter, producer guy.
All right, then.
Did a whole album with him, and I asked him one day when I started the radio show, I said, hey, would you do my voiceover IDs? Because you have this cool voice. And he used to be in radio back in Texas. I think he was in school. And so I took a lot of convincing, though. He really didn't want to do it. But I think he did a fine job.
He did a great job.
So you did a lot of the voiceover stuff like that. Local restaurants, resorts. Any funny stories from doing voiceover work? Or? It's not a place for funny stories. Nothing happens.
The funny stories usually happen in creating stuff. Back when I was a production director, I had a staff of two other people. We'd get together and write. And that's when just crazy stuff happens. And it had to be the one rule in the building that we had was I close the door, there's no rules in the room, and no idea is stupid. And some of them really were, but at least they were comical. But no, that whole game is just usually when you're at a radio station, a salesman comes back and says, I need this on spec. Can you write me a copy on spec?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So for every 25 pieces of copy and music you create, everything you produce, maybe one, you know, mm-hmm. goes to a contract. But in the meantime, that's my gig. I'm just going to have fun doing it. You know?
Any of your kids follow you in the radio industry?
No, they were all smart enough to realize I'm not doing that.
We saw Dad do that.
Exactly. Dad got up awfully early.
So they all did something else.
That's
huh?
right.
So what's
yeah.
everybody doing?
I was just on the phone before I came here with my son, who's in the Navy.
Okay.
He's you have to say submariner. I've always said submariner, but they don't like that. So he's on a ballistic missile sub.
Wow.
Which just freaks me out that my kid's in a submarine. It's like, how do you do that? And the kids have all pretty much scattered to the wind. Our oldest, we're a combined family, so Jordan is still here in town and doing great. She's one of those creative souls. She and her husband Danny, they've just been traveling around Central America back here. Now they're about to go back out on the road. My older daughter, Morgan, is in Reno, Sparks area. Her husband's now working for Tesla, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
They have grandkids who are, man, just knocks me out, 16 and 15 next week.
You see, I know how to avoid the whole becoming a grandfather thing. You make sure your kid gets divorced before they have any kids. So every time my daughter meets another guy, I just break them up. You know, I do something. No.
Kennan, who was the one who had great interest in becoming a songwriter, trying to play, she wanted to go straight to bass. And Dad said, no, you got to start. You got to play guitar. You're going to learn to read. And so she never did. She's in Portland now and working with a startup internet company. And one of our kids, who was actually the one who was the most interested in music, actually studied classical guitar. He's now writing software. So everybody's doing fine.
But at least he's still a writer.
They're all making money. That's what's nice.
That's a key. You know? That's a key. Yeah. So you're a big fan from popular music. You're a fan of Mark Knopfler's Mary Chapin Carpenter. You mentioned Brandi Carlile in a note that you sent me. Brandy's awesome.
Oh, I remember the way I found her was I was on iTunes one day. It's, well, years ago now. And Columbia was giving away a tune. And I listened to the tune. Mm-hmm. And I had to buy this record, so I've been buying everything ever since. So,
yeah. Alison Krauss is another one. And yeah, then you mentioned that you're a fan of Lady Gaga's, and then you said, yeah, I know. It's like you thought I would admonish you for that. She's a great singer.
She is, but nobody knows it.
I know. She's an odd one by the thought that a lot of people act crazy in pop music to get noticed because they don't have any talent.
Mm-hmm.
She has unbelievable talent, acted crazy to get noticed, and you realize, oh my God, even when you're that good, it doesn't really matter. You still got to be crazy and get on the screen, get in the shots. You know?
Wear the meat dress. Yeah.
Yeah, the meat dress.
And it was a long time before even I realized that this is a talented person.
Yeah, she wasn't aiming for people to know that because that was irrelevant.
And then she does the Tony Bennett thing. And I thought, okay, yeah, see, I told you right there. You know?
Yeah,
even my kids are saying, you like Lady Gaga? I can't say I'm listening to Lady Gaga all the time, but you ask me, you know, who do you?
Right.
I admire. But Mark Knopfler, I think, is just an amazing songwriter. Great guitar player.
Mm-hmm. And when we also talked about, I always like to ask people, you know, kind of different people they'd like to spend some time with or artists that they admire. And you mentioned Danny O'Keefe, who we played a cut of. But you also mentioned a couple other people, Peter Korn and Bill Bryson. Bill's an author I'm familiar with. But where was your interest in these guys? Where was this developed?
Bill Bryson I was introduced to through a friend who had bought a book on tape, which was, my introduction to him was a book called The Complete History of Nearly Everything.
Right. I mean, that's his biggest book, isn't it?
Probably.
Yeah.
And I've since, you know, I now have my Bill Bryson shelf. But that was the book that, if you've read it, the opening sentence in the foreword is, congratulations, you made it, you know, alluding to the idea. You are here because your ancestors made it through all that stuff. So congratulations, because of genetic code, you happen to be here.
Right.
Peter Korn was a woodworker, and I was just finishing reading his latest book. I'd read some of his woodworking books, because I work with wood, and his articles in Taunton Press. This book is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. And it's a brilliant book. And in fact, I just wrote him a letter thanking him for kind of reigniting the feeling like my existence is justified yet again, and kind of spurring me on to keep trying to be creative.
That is interesting. Now, you talked about woodworking and making things. Does that have anything to do with the cast you have in your hand today?
Yeah, my wife likes to say I abuse my body, and for some reason it keeps bouncing back, but the older I get, it bounces a little lower.
That's right. It's a little longer on the healing.
I was rebuilding the third iteration of taking my house apart and putting it back together, redesigning it.
Mm-hmm.
And this time, Jeannie, my wife, went behind me and put flooring in. And we spent a lot of money on floors so I wouldn't take any more walls out. But in doing that, it's just all the power tools you're using with your hands and stuff. And I did damage my hand at one point. It just weakened my thumbs, and so swinging a golf club actually, and I just blew the tendon out on this thumb. So
wow.
Yeah.
So now obviously you can't play guitar really, really well or easily.
Yeah, I'm not supposed to play at all. So it'll be 6 months before I know if I'll be able to play
again.
Yeah.
And it might put an end to your playing guitar career?
Yeah, unless I can figure something else out. You know, Django played with three fingers, so
there you go.
Maybe I'll be a thumbless guitar
just
player.
Flip it over the other way. Use your other hand.
Yeah, sure. There you go.
Just need to hold that. You can hold a pick on your thumb or something on this one. Well, I think you'll be okay. But you actually you've written some stuff and recorded the guitar so that you're ready to go, right? Either way.
I went back and recorded a couple of things that I wanted to be sure were down, just so I hadn't lost them. Yeah.
Cool. Well, we'll have to get together and listen to some of that stuff. But in the meantime, we're running up on the end of our hour. So I just wanted to thank you for coming in. I really appreciate you taking the time to visit with me.
This has been a gas. Thanks, Adam.
And hear a little bit of your backstory. Born in Phoenix, Arizona. Married a girl who was born in Phoenix, Arizona. I don't think I know anybody else like that.
I am one of a kind.
You are. So tune into KBOC Monday morning through Saturday morning.
That's right. Tomorrow morning.
From 5 to 10.
Yeah, that's me.
I won't be tuning in.
Coward.
Talk to you later.